October 24, 1944. The sun was barely up over the Philippine Sea when the radar operators aboard the carrier Essex spotted them. A formation of Japanese aircraft, 60 strong, inbound and tightening up, bearing down on the American fleet at Leyte Gulf. The largest naval battle in recorded history was already unfolding on the surface and beneath the waves. Battleships, cruisers, destroyers, all of it. But what was about to happen 3 miles above all of that, in the cockpit of a single Grumman fighter, that part of the story has been almost forgotten. I'm Taildragger, this is The Hangar on Radio Hangar. And today we're talking about Commander David McCampbell, the airplane he flew, and the 90 minutes that made him the deadliest naval aviator in American history. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Before we get to that October morning, you need to understand the airplane McCampbell was flying, because the Grumman F-6 Hellcat didn't just carry the best pilot of the Pacific War. It was specifically, deliberately, almost surgically designed to fix a problem that was killing American pilots. By the spring of 1942, the Navy had a serious problem. The Mitsubishi A6M, which everyone was calling the Zero, was making mincemeat of American carrier fighters. The Grumman F-4F Wildcat was a tough airplane, honest and rugged and forgiving, to land on a moving deck in a 20-knot crosswind. But in a turning fight, the Zero was in a different category. It could outclimb the Wildcat, outturn it, and simply run away when things went bad. American pilots were developing tactics to survive. The THAC weave, dive, and zoom never follow a Zero into a slow-speed turning engagement. They were staying alive on cleverness because their machine wasn't good enough. Then in June of 42, something extraordinary happened. A Japanese pilot named Tadayoshi Koga was flying patrol over the Aleutian Islands when he took hits and went down. He put his Zero into a field on Akutan Island. The gear caught in the soft tundra, the aircraft flipped and Koga didn't survive, but the airplane did, largely intact. American salvage crews recovered that Zero. They cleaned it up, repaired the systems, flew it, pushed it through every corner of its envelope, and instrumented it down to the last data point, and then they handed every performance number, every design weakness, every structural decision, straight to Grumman on Long Island. Grumman already had a new fighter on the drawing board. Now they knew exactly what they were designing against. The result was the F-6F Hellcat, and I want you to picture this airplane for a moment, because the Hellcat does not look like a thoroughbred. It doesn't have the elegant curves of a Spitfire. It doesn't have the menace of a P-40 Warhawk with a shark mouth painted on the cowling. The Hellcat looks like a machine built by practical men who were not interested in elegance. Big, wide, heavy. The landing gear was planted so far apart that a carrier landing in rough seas was just an inconvenience rather than a fatal bet. The pilots sat high in the cockpit, and the visibility was something the Zero pilots only dreamed about. The canopy gave you the sky in almost every direction that mattered. Under the cowling was a Pratt & Whitney R2800 Double Wasp, 18 cylinders arranged in two rows, 2,000 horsepower. The Zero's engine was producing somewhere around 940 horsepower on a good day, and behind the pilots sat armor plate. The fuel tanks were self-sealing, 650 caliber machine guns in the wings, each one carrying 400 rounds. When a Hellcat took hits and came home, the deck crew could turn it around in hours. The airplane was not designed to be babied. It was designed to absorb punishment and keep flying. The Zero pilot who tried to follow a Hellcat into a dive was making the last mistake he would ever make. The Zero's airframe would start failing structurally above about 400 miles per hour. The Hellcat was already past that and pulling away.
Grumman built them fast. Design finalized in January of 43. Hellcats flying combat from carrier decks by that October. By the end of the war, Grumman had delivered over 12,000 of them. That production rate was possible because they kept the design honest. No chasing aerodynamic perfection at the cost of reliability. Build it strong, build it fast, build it replaceable. By June of 44, the combination of the Hellcat and 3 years of American pilot training had produced something that looked almost impossible on paper at the Battle of the Philippine Sea. In a single day of combat over the Marianas, American Hellcat pilots shot down approximately 300 Japanese aircraft, while losing 23 of their own. The kill ratio was so lopsided that American pilots started calling it the Great Marianas Turkey Shoot. It was the day Japan's carrier aviation, built over a decade at enormous cost, effectively ceased to exist as a fighting force. But Japan could still put airplanes in the sky, and in October of 44, with American forces landing on Leyte and threatening to sever Japan's supply lines to the south, Japan committed everything it had left in one desperate, all-in move. The goal was to destroy the American invasion fleet at Leyte Gulf before it could establish itself, If they could pull it off, the Philippines campaign would collapse. The war in the Pacific would drag on, possibly for years, which is why what happened on October 24th mattered. This wasn't a skirmish. The Japanese aircraft pushing south were headed for transports full of troops and supply ships. They couldn't defend themselves. Now here's where it gets interesting. David McCampbell was 40 years old. 40. Most of the young men flying off those carrier decks were in their early 20s. McCampbell had been in the Navy since 1929, Naval Academy graduate, class of 33. He had gotten his wings in 38 and spent the early years of the war in training commands and administrative posts, which frustrated him greatly. He didn't fly his first combat mission until 1943. But when he finally got into the fight, it became clear very quickly that this was what he had been built for.
He had a quality that the finest fighter pilots share. He could read a developing aerial engagement the way a chess grandmaster reads a board, several moves ahead of where the fight actually was. He saw the geometry of it, where the formation was going, where it would be vulnerable, where the energy was, and he had the cold, precise aggression to act on what he saw before anyone else had processed it. By the morning of October 24th, McCampbell commanded Air Group 15 aboard Essex. He had 19 confirmed kills. He was already one of the leading aces in the Pacific. The radar was showing that formation pushing in from the north. 60 or more Japanese aircraft, tightly grouped inbound. The ready fighters had already been committed elsewhere. McCampbell launched with one other pilot, his wingman Ensign Roy Rushing, two Hellcats. He climbed hard, got above the formation, positioned himself with the sun at his back, and attacked. What followed over the next hour and a half is one of the most extraordinary aerial engagements in the history of naval aviation. McCampbell worked the Hellcat's speed advantage relentlessly. Dive from above through the formation, fire, pull out below, climb back up, reposition, dive again. He was hunting the formation leaders. He understood that a large formation depends on its structure, and that structure depends on the men flying point. When the leader went down, the formation hesitated. When the next leader went down, confusion spread. The Japanese pilots he was fighting were largely replacement crews. Japan had bled out its best aviators in the battles leading to 44, Coral Sea, Midway, the Solomons, the Marianas. What McCampbell faced were young men with limited hours, trained in a pipeline that attrition had chewed to nothing. Dangerous enough, but not the veterans of Pearl Harbor. McCampbell kept working, diving, firing, climbing, repositioning. The Hellcat's engine pulling hard on each climb out, the guns hammering on each pass. Rushing protected his six and racked up kills of his own. When McCampbell finally broke off, he had expended every round of ammunition in every gun, not a round left. 9 Japanese aircraft confirmed destroyed. 1 more probable, Rushing had added 6, 2 Hellcats, 90 minutes, 15 kills between them. The Japanese formation, what remained of it, turned back and did not reach the fleet. Then McCampbell had a fuel problem.
He had been running combat power for over an hour and a half over the open Philippine Sea. He was a long way from Essex, and the fuel numbers weren't going to work. He declared an emergency, pointed south toward the fleet, and landed aboard the first carrier he could reach because he did not have enough fuel to find his own ship. The deck crew helped him out of the cockpit, not wounded, just emptied out. Burned through in the way that happens when a man runs that hard for that long with nothing left to give. Total kills for David McCampbell. End of war. 34 confirmed, more than any other Navy or Marine Corps pilot in American history. The Medal of Honor citation for October 24th says he engaged 60 aircraft with one wingman, and then uses the word aggressively to describe it. That is a military understatement of the highest order. The Hellcat's overall war record is staggering. 19-to-1 kill ratio in air-to-air combat across the Pacific. Over 5,000 Japanese aircraft destroyed in aerial engagements against fewer than 300 Hellcats lost in the same fights. No other Allied fighter in any theater of the war posted numbers like that. The airplane alone didn't do it. The training pipeline was a piece of it. American pilots in 44 had hundreds of hours before they saw combat. The industrial base was a piece of it, but the Hellcat was the right machine at the right moment, and that combination does not come together often. McCampbell survived the war, stayed in the Navy, retired as a captain in 1971. He died in 1996 at 92 years old. By every account, he was generous at aviation events and gracious about the legend. He talked about his mechanics and his deck crews as much as he talked about the flying, the way the real ones always do. Most of the Hellcats are gone now. Out of 12,000 built, only a handful are airworthy today. When you see one at an air show, stop and look at it a minute. It's ungainly on the ground. Nose high, tail down, wide set gear planted like it's daring the deck to move. It doesn't look like something that changed the course of a war, but it did. Sources today come from Barrett Tillman's Definitive History of the Hellcat, the Naval History and Heritage Command's records on Air Group 15,
and McCampbell's Medal of Honor citation, which anyone can read through the Congressional Medal of Honor Society. Find us at radiohanger.com. I'm Taildragger. Keep the shiny side up.